You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We looked at the Spanish flu from a global perspective yesterday with science journalist Laura Spinney. Today, we zoom in on Wisconsin, which had an advanced public health system in 1918. We were the only state to respond to the deadly flu pandemic with uniform statewide shutdowns. So schools, colleges, churches, theaters, they were all closed indefinitely under an order by the state health officer at that time, Dr. Cornelius Harper. What do you want to know about this time in Wisconsin? What parallels do you draw between then and now? We're at 800-642-1234. Jim Malowitz is investigations editor at Wisconsin Watch. That's the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. His new article explores how the history of the flu pandemic may inform how we look at our current social distancing and public health efforts. Jim, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
Well, take us back to 1918 in Wisconsin. We're seeing at the time almost 8,500 Wisconsinites die from the flu pandemic. What was going on here?
Sure. Well, in a lot of ways, the Wisconsinites in 1918 were dealing with what we are now, although things have certainly changed in the past 100 years. We had this virus, the flu, come in. We didn't have a vaccine for it. We didn't have drugs to treat for it. And really, public health officials at that time in Wisconsin decided that really the only thing that Wisconsinites could do to try to prevent it from spreading were these uniform shutdown measures that you described, along the very similar lines of what we're dealing with today. And in researching this piece, I looked at a lot of old newspaper articles, and while some of the language was different, just the way people spoke, in a lot of ways, they had very much very similar debates as we're having now about, is it okay to shut down public gatherings statewide that might be very very economically crippling or just uncomfortable. And for the most part, Wisconsinites complied.
They, for the most part, complied. What were some of the hiccups along the way? When did they not fall in favor of following the public health officer at the time?
Sure. Well, it was around October 10th, 1918, when the public health officer issued his order. And almost statewide immediately, historians describe cities falling in line and uniformly so for really the next month or so. There were a few miscommunications. There was a miscommunication in Wausau where Wausau thought it was optional, but they fell in line within a day or two. But really, my article also explores what happened about a month in. The health officer decided to lighten up in some ways to give local governments a choice as to whether to open because this flu was hitting Wisconsin unevenly. So you saw Milwaukee, which was more dense, did see a lot more deaths, something along the lines of 1,300, although that was less than other big cities at the time. But you had more rural places that weren't seeing as many deaths. And local governments, counties, had the choice as to whether or not to open and when. And we did see after that decision some cases where local governments opened and then the flu came in or it came back and they had to close again.
Which has been a conversation we've been hearing today among lawmakers of allowing perhaps more rural areas where we haven't seen as many cases to open sooner.
Correct. Yeah. And if you look at a map, obviously none of your listeners can look at a map right now, of the 1918 deaths by county, you'll see in a lot of very rural counties, and keep in mind that Wisconsin had about half the population or less than it does now, in a lot of really rural counties in 1918, you still saw over 100 deaths or at least dozens of deaths. And so the virus still was able to make its way into these rural counties, even when we didn't have as robust of a transportation system. It found a way into the counties.
We're talking with Jim Malowitz, investigations editor at Wisconsin Watch. He's been reporting on how Wisconsin responded to the 1918 flu pandemic. And what the takeaways are for our current situation. You can join in with your questions. What do you want to know about how Wisconsin responded in 1918? What parallels do you see between then and now? Are there any? What changes to our society over the past century have most affected how we respond to pandemics? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jim, while you say that there were a lot of deaths in Milwaukee, it actually did, though, have a lower death rate than many other big cities. What was happening there in Milwaukee?
That's correct. Well, Milwaukee shut down around the same time that the state did. So there was that. There was the deaths limited by that state shutdown. But historians describe an incredibly robust public health system. The state had a system in place that had been in place since the 1870s when it built a health department, and Milwaukee had a strong system as well that had been in place since the mid-19th century, and reformers at the time had pressed for government action to address problems like smallpox or tainted milk or even uncollected trash. So you had this infrastructure in place to be able to communicate public health messages to the people who the government decided needed to hear them. And it was also very sort of multi-partisan, or you know, it was less polarizing at that time in the city. You had a socialist government set up, but also the health commissioner in 1918, George C. Ruland, was big on getting consensus. So immediately when Milwaukee started seeing flu crop up in the city in late September, Ruland put together a commission to immediately study it and then to get public education materials out, signs saying "Don't spit, please cough into a handkerchief," and also very quickly communicating with newspapers to say, you know, "Can you please help us educate the public on what they need to do to stay safe." So it was really this massive education campaign and a really huge response in the city, as well as we saw statewide to falling in line. Historians at the time talk about how folks at the time equated patriotism with following what the government says. We don't necessarily do that today, but that was the atmosphere at the time.
Do you see some of those public health campaigns carrying over into the newspaper pages? What did that look like?
You'd see signs, you know, saying "Don't cough, don't sneeze, don't spit, use your handkerchief." You'd see ads that just talked about staying distant and really good hygiene were some of the main things. And you see them throughout the newspapers. You would also see, on the other hand, sometimes companies selling dubious products to treat the flu that you see now. Sometimes
the scams were still there that time, too.
They were there. So you'd see that, too. But really, like the bigger thing you would notice was just these types of posters that would be printed in the newspapers or sometimes printed on streetcars at the time to educate the public on hygiene.
Were the posters having similar images? Did you see the same look and feel throughout the state?
It kind of varied, and I guess okay. I didn't do a systematic analysis of like across the state, but you know, you'd see posters that say, you know, the flu is increasing. If you want to play safe, you know, here are some of the rules. You know, avoid drinking out of common cups and keep out of. So some of them were kind of funny messages that we don't know if hold up today. Keep out of dusty places. I mean, maybe and so forth.
We're talking with Wisconsin Watch Investigations editor Jim Malowitz is here as our guide to how our state responded to the Spanish flu pandemic a century ago that killed almost 8,500 people here in Wisconsin. What do you want to know about Wisconsin's public health system at the time? What changes to our society over the past century have most affected how we respond to disease? Be part of this, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're taking a closer look at how Wisconsin responded to the deadly flu pandemic of 1918. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Historians say Wisconsin took bold measures a century ago, and the flu pandemic struck at a time when Wisconsinites held widespread faith in government, and patriotism meant following orders of public officials. Do you have family members who've passed down stories about what this time was like? What happened to your ancestors during the flu pandemic? Share your stories, what you've learned in your family history, 800-642-1234. Jim Malowitz is investigations editor at Wisconsin Watch. He interviewed historians and surveyed newspaper coverage across the state involving the 1918 pandemic. He stays with us. Let's take a call now. Steve is here from Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You know, obviously I wasn't around in 1918, but I can kind of look at what's happening in today's world and wondering if it was the same. You know, we have our current governor has not really kept the Republicans involved in any of the decision-making process, which I think alienated a lot of people. And I'm wondering, in 1918, was our government as divided? I know the guest just talked about consensus in Milwaukee, which I think helps when you have people, you can bring people together to fight something that's non-political, which hasn't happened by our governor.
Steve, thanks. Jim, how do we know, what do we know about how decisions were made about the flu outbreak then?
Sure, that's a really great question, Steve. And obviously, I don't have the privilege of having been able to really peer into the nitty gritty of decision making at the time from the governor's office and the state health officer. But I can say from looking at newspaper coverage, I did not see any really sort of partisan debate at all at the state level. It seemed like the state of Wisconsin really kind of acted, or at least was able to project a unified voice. And the state had entrusted a lot of power in the state health officer at the time, and folks complied. That was definitely one big difference that I saw from coverage then as compared to now. We obviously have big partisan fights and so forth, and we're definitely more polarized on a partisan level right now. That definitely did not come across in my research of this, and it seemed like Wisconsin politics were fairly unified at that time. Not to say there weren't any dissenting voices from business folk at the time. I definitely saw that, but from a political level, I didn't see the sort of rancor that we sometimes see now.
Lou from northern Wisconsin called in, couldn't stay with us, but called to say that Ashland was booming in the late 1800s and was a vital, active community back then. What happened to places like Ashland? Did they continue to have a bustling economy before and after the flu outbreak?
Sure. Well, I mean, the flu outbreak definitely hit places like Ashland hard. If anyone is able to read my article and see the county by county map of deaths, Ashland actually falls in the category of having some of the most deaths per capita in Wisconsin as a county. There definitely was. I didn't as much get into the recovery in my story, but there has been research since about how a lot of the local governments that actually shut down sooner and stayed shut down later, at least on a national level, were able to economically recover a little bit quicker. I can't really speak to Ashland and how closely it recovered, but definitely the length of the shutdown played a role in how quickly some of these communities were able to recover.
When the World War I came to an end, that also had a role in spreading the disease. What happened there in Wisconsin?
Right. That World War I played a huge role in this, and I'm sorry I didn't mention it earlier. This was all going on near the end of the war. So in November 11th, 1918, Wisconsin cities and cities all over the country got word that an armistice had been signed and the Allies had made peace with the Germans. And so in parts of Wisconsin, definitely not everywhere, but I looked at coverage of Oshkosh papers and other newspapers in that part of Wisconsin. You saw big parades. And Oshkosh was a really interesting case to look at because Oshkosh reopened its economy on November 4th. It was opening schools. It was opening public gathering places. But even then, the mayor at the time, Arthur C. McHenry, warned that the state wasn't out of the woods. He said, you know, still practice safe Don't spit. Try to keep
your distance. Do the 1918 version of social distancing.
yes, basically, and spitting was big. Don't do that. He was saying we're not out of the woods yet. And the armistice was signed about just a week later, and everybody forgot about the pandemic. McHenry forgot. He was marching in a parade. There were over 250 autos lined up. There were people pounding sledgehammers on bells and anvils. And just days after that parade, you see the flu cases surge again, and people died. And Oshkosh actually had to reinstitute its ban just shortly after the parade. And the very same thing happened down the road in Neenah as well, where there was a giant parade. And then about a month later, there were reports of roughly half the town having the flu.
Wow. We're talking with Jim Malowitz, investigations editor at Wisconsin Wash, exploring how the 1918 flu pandemic hit Wisconsin, how it might enlighten us today, knowing what happened then. Join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. So, Jim, you just pored over old newspaper reports from around the state. What stands out to you in how the reporters were covering this pandemic?
Coverage was definitely different. There was probably less analysis than we're used to seeing now. And honestly, not to pat all my colleagues on the back, I think we are more skeptical of some of the messages we hear from public officials, or at least do more digging when it comes to really looking at data, analyzing things. I think reporting now also tends to provide a lot more backstory type context that would have made it easier if that was around in 1918, it would have made it a lot easier to research these articles, because a lot of them are just one announcement without context, and you have to go to the next one rather than reading one story and getting the whole story. So definitely reporting was different, but there were times when I'd be reading an article where they're talking to various parties about the wisdom of an order, and you would hear a couple voices of dissent, you'd hear voices of approval, where it would seem like a more traditional coverage of, say, city hall or state politics, but a little bit less analysis, I would say.
Were there big regional variations in how this disease was spreading? I mean, you mentioned the parades there and what happened after, but did you see like pockets and waves of the disease?
Definitely. Well, and the disease was stronger in southeast Wisconsin earlier on when it hit Milwaukee in late September, which it's thought to maybe have come from a naval base and some visiting sailors who fell ill. It took a little while for the disease to kind of get up north, and I don't have an exact distribution of how that worked, but I definitely saw in early November, parts of Dodge County, for instance, had their newspaper accounts where you could see like, oh, you know, it seems like we didn't get hit hard or we're out of the woods. And then by more mid-November, even if they didn't have a parade or a reported parade, they actually had to reshut down after the state made it optional. So it definitely was, there were definitely pockets. It didn't spread evenly. But again, if you look, you know, by the end of the year and you look at a map of where deaths occurred, it did touch every part of the state. It got all the way up north. I mean, even as far north as Douglas County, you saw 151 deaths in a pretty, you know, not a huge community. So it definitely got around.
I'm wondering, as you looked at so many different newspapers around the state from this era, did you stumble on any other curiosities that you weren't expecting, maybe related or not related to the pandemic?
I did. There's one story that is absolutely fascinating to me about what happened in Kenosha about a month before the armistice was signed. There was a telegram that came out from a Chicago newspaper that went all over the country, and it's kind of hard to parse the language, but it looks like basically this was almost the modern day equivalent of kind of fake news or almost clickbaity journalism. The telegram said that the Germans were looking for peace, and again, this was a month before the armistice was signed, and a lot of newspapers and towns kind of didn't really bite on it because they saw like this wasn't actual peace, this wasn't really news. But the mayor of Kenosha ran with it. He called people out to the street and to celebrate what he thought was the end of the war. And there was this series of spontaneous celebrations across Kenosha it sounded like they happened for maybe a half hour or an hour before people finally realized, made some calls
that this was premature.
That this was premature. And actually, one of the newspaper accounts talks about how a delegation from Racine came down to see what the hubbub was and then ended up having a good laugh at the expense of Kenosha.
Well, Jim, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Jim Malowitz is investigations editor at Wisconsin Watch. You can find a link to his reporting on our website at wpr.org/mornings. Coming up, how the UW system is coping with a pandemic and what it means for its nearly 200,000 students and more than 40,000 employees. We talk with the system administrator right after this news update on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Just a quick mention that we are fielding your questions about COVID-19 through our Wisconsin project. So you can submit your questions about COVID-19. We'll do our best to answer them. Go to wpr.org/COVID. Right now, we're checking back in with how the UW system is responding to the pandemic. 1 week ago, system campuses announced their initial furlough plans for employees to address these unprecedented budget shortfalls caused by the pandemic. And in recent days, we're seeing plans emerge that are more tailored, more campus-specific, ranging from intermittent furloughs to several months of consecutive unpaid leave for staff unable to work remotely. Are you a UW system employee facing a furlough? What does this mean for your teaching and your research? Are you a UW student who may not be able to return in the fall because of financial hardship? What options are you weighing? Be part of this at 800-642-1234. Robert Kramer is the UW system's vice president for administration. Robert, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Okay, good morning. It's nice to be back.
Well, explain where we're at here as we check in. The UW Board of Regents announced, system-wide furloughs to help make up this $170 million revenue drop. What does that look like across the campuses? What are the plans?
So I think your overview is pretty concise and accurate. The board approved for all the campuses the furlough policy, and now institutions are deciding how to tailor that for their particular needs. And I think at this point, over half of the UW campuses have announced furlough plans, as you noted, either intermittent, which might mean one day a month, or longer term for employees where there's no work that can be done offsite or the revenue sources have essentially stopped. A number of our employees are obviously funded by things like dining and residence halls. And as we look forward, we're trying to make sure that we are keeping the financial stewardship of our resources front and center as we decide how to move through the next several months.
Do you have any timeline for the remainder of the campuses that have not announced their budgeting and furlough plans?
So system has not set a timeline for campuses to make announcements. We obviously are entering May pretty quickly here. And as May comes up, I think campuses will need to do that. But one of our goals on this has been how to help campuses, assist campuses, but not be too directive as they deal with the COVID pandemic impacts locally.
Our campuses, as you talk with them, are they contemplating layoffs?
I think campuses are looking at a number of workforce issues. Furloughs is the starting point. Everyone wanted to try and make sure that employees knew that this was being seen as a temporary interruption at this point. Temporary is being a little bit undefined right now because we don't know how long the pandemic's effects will play out. I think layoffs are something people will have to think about going forward.
What other cost-cutting measures are you seeing the campuses do, and what are you advising on them? Where can they trim?
So there's a number of areas that we're working with campuses on. Obviously, some costs are already going down because of this. I think we reported about $30 to $35 million in savings across the institutions from things like reduced travel, utility savings, and other things through about the middle of April. The things we're looking at now is how do we do some things more focused on sharing services. The past several years, we've set up a number of programs to essentially take advantage of our scale. So, for example, a number of institutions now have their student information systems being supported and hosted by a shared services group rather than trying to do that campus by campus. Majority of the comprehensives also now have their payroll function being provided as a service rather than doing that individually.
Oh, so you centralize a particular service or resource, and then that way you can dispatch it across different campuses, and that is basically able to consolidate and save funding there.
Exactly. We were essentially standardize how the work is being done, streamline the work, and then coordinate and consolidate it.
We're talking with Robert Kramer. He is the UW Systems Vice President for Administration, and we're checking in on how the system is addressing the pandemic and making up for lost revenue. With your questions front and center, are you a UW System employee who is facing a furlough? How hard of a financial hit will that be for you? Are you a student who may not be able to return in the fall? Tell us about the options you're considering at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So, Robert, the system is slated to get $47 million in aid from the Federal CARES Act. How will this money be distributed, and have you received it yet?
So each institution is able to apply for their portion of those funds. The CARES Act provided monies that were intended to go directly to students as emergency grants, and our campuses are working on getting those distributed. That's about $47 million. And then, as you noted, there's another roughly $47 million available to institutions to help with their COVID costs. And the campuses are in the process of going through that application to the Department of Education now.
What does that application look like? What do they need to prove?
I think it's fairly straightforward. They need to identify that they're going to use the funds appropriately. They have to apply for the student monies first, because it's a priority of the department to get that aid out to the students. And then they have to test that they're going to use the money as intended.
And using the funding as intended, where do the campuses need it most right now? Where are they seeing the budget bleed, if you will?
So I think a couple of things to highlight. Obviously, the financial impact on residence halls and dining services, where we returned monies to students. The April impact that we had acknowledged or identified was about $168 million of cost to institutions. A large amount of that was the funds returned. Some of the other things that we are seeing, and we've communicated to our elected officials, providing more support for students, both in their move to online instruction, but also providing services for their behavioral and mental well-being. I think this is a situation no one had expected back in January, and a number of students are finding the transition to online difficult, and also in some cases they have other responsibilities, such as maybe helping with childcare with the schools closed. And so we want to make sure that we're providing additional services to them.
What might that support look like specifically as students try to move to an online learning platform? What is getting in the way of them able to connect with their courses online?
So there's been a couple barriers that we've identified. One is just having a computer or device that can access. And a number of our campuses have made hundreds of computers available to students to help them out. And we still have some students remaining in residence halls, also because of that or other complications that they could not return to their home. Another thing of it is providing basically some form of telemedicine so that they have someone they can reach out to and talk to about their concerns, their issues, their challenges. I know a number of the campuses have set up basically calling plans to reach out to students to check in proactively with them to see how both their academics are doing and how they're doing personally. I think that's an important aspect going forward.
Do you worry that some of these students will just fall through the cracks and disappear off your rolls?
You know, student success has been something we've been emphasizing more and more over the last several years. So that is something that I think is a concern, not only within the UW system, but across higher education because of this very sudden and unexpected change. And so it's going to be an area of focus for us, not only now, but going forward, how to stay in touch with students, how to help them navigate through this, and how to help them either, you know, graduate this spring or make sure they continue to make progress toward their academic degree and their goals in life.
There's been some sentiment out there that a degree that they're taking online classes exclusively, that they're not getting the full education, that they're not getting the full entree, if you will, of that coursework. How would you address that?
Well, I think it's important to acknowledge that students who chose to have their education on the UW campus, that was not what they were anticipating for this year. No one was. And I think faculty are doing their utmost to provide the academic experience. Going forward, we need to draw some lessons from this and identify how to improve the online experience for students in the future. But it's important to acknowledge that. That's not what those students expected.
How do you start improving this? I know that you were ready to go to the cloud well before this pandemic unfolded. That is one silver lining. But how do you make this better for students online?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things. A number of the campuses are surveying students to get direct feedback from them in terms of what will be helpful for them going forward. Again, faculty and others reaching out to the students and making sure they have those personal connections, even as the instruction is being done either online or through some other alternative delivery. I think another piece of it is going to be stepping back after the semester is done and looking at the course design and identifying where we can make improvements in the online courses, and then also really focusing on providing some additional professional development and training and support for the faculty, because this is new for them also, and they have been doing a remarkable job just helping students get through the semester. And I want to give my thanks and appreciation to all of them because they've been working very, very hard to support our students.
Is there a possibility that the UW will have to close any of the campuses to deal with this funding drop?
So at this point, I don't think that is something that's in the scenarios we're looking at. The short-term monies through this semester, about $168 million, is very significant. Looking forward, we're trying to understand what the possible scenarios are for the summer and the fall, and there's been a number of possibilities identified by different chancellors and university presidents, ranging from students returning in the fall to being more all online. Depending on which one of those scenarios we see playing out, has very different implications for our campuses and our communities.
Pausing there with UW System Vice President Robert Kramer. He oversees facilities planning, information technology, human resources. Are you a family with a student at the UW? How has the pandemic changed their plans? How are you adjusting? Call in. We'll be back in a moment on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Initial projections showed UW system campuses faced nearly $170 million in revenue losses for the spring semester. And in recent days, furlough plans have started to come forward. We're finding out how UW campuses are shoring up their budgets amid the pandemic. Are you a high school student who dreamed of attending college out of state but are now considering a local UW campus as a better option? Are you a UW employee facing furlough? What does this mean for your livelihood and your stability? What do you want to know from the UW system right now? We're at 800-642-1234. We have Robert Kramer, Vice President for Administration of the UW system. He stays with us. Robert, I want to go back to the CARES Act for a moment. And with the funding, the $47 million or so allocated for students, how is that funding being distributed to students?
Yeah, so that's a great question. The Department of Education moved very quickly to make that funding available after Congress acted, which we certainly appreciated. That money is being distributed by financial aid officers at each institution. It was distributed to institutions through a federal formula, which made it quick and easy to get the money identified and to us. And the financial aid officers who work with students on a regular basis have a good background and experience to help identify how to get that money to students to help them with their emergency needs.
Should students right now be reaching out to their financial aid officer or their faculty advisor? Who should they be in contact with right now?
Your institutions have been keeping students apprised, both through emails and their websites. So they should be tracking on those to identify how the money is being distributed and what they need to do. Important piece of the puzzle has been if they have done a FAFSA or not. So they may want to check the websites to see the most current information from their campus.
How has enrollment been affected by the pandemic so far? Is it too soon to tell?
I think it's too soon to tell. The numbers were tracking in a positive direction for many of our campuses in late February. A number of the branch campuses from the old DWA colleges actually were seeing fairly significant increases in the number of applications. And a couple of campuses still report that applications are up. But I think it's too early to tell for the fall. There's a lot of just question marks that people are working through.
Let's bring in a call now. Kevin is with us from Milwaukee. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, my son attends University of Wisconsin. He's a junior. And I believe if they're going to have the school online, I think we, the people that pay the parents and the students, should have a serious discount, because paying full tuition for an experience when you basically get this information online for free, it's not fair to the students or whoever's paying the tuition. So,
Kevin, may I ask what your student is majoring in? What's their major?
Engineering, which is even worse, because if you can't get to the labs, you know, I know my personal feeling is something like this, they're better off just shutting school down for a year. The kids are getting seriously shortchanged. They're not learning nearly as much.
Kevin, thank you for the call. I want Robert to be able to respond to that. An engineering student there, and Kevin says they're not getting that learning that they need.
Yeah, I appreciate Kevin's point and concerns. And I think it was important to acknowledge those concerns and that this semester is not what any of us expected. You know, when you think about the way the tuition works within the DWA system, for most of the campuses, tuition covers 60-70% of the instructional budget, if not more. And so even in the online experience, those dollars are being used to pay the faculty and others who are working with the students. So there's probably no good answer to this cycle, but ensuring that students could make some progress this spring was our first priority.
What does this picture look like for international students? How are you reaching out to them? What is their situation like?
So for each campus, international students has been an area of emphasis for them because this pandemic has affected them differently. At a number of our institutions, the international students have remained in the residence halls because of just the travel challenges. In some other institutions, they've been able to return home. Looking ahead, I think one of the big question marks for enrollment in the fall will be, are there international students able to return to UW institutions, or will they need to either look at some alternatives for the fall or potentially take their courses online?
How long will they be able to remain in residence halls in this limbo? How long will you have them open?
So for the housing, I think we want to make sure that we are providing them housing as long as necessary. One of the other elements that we're working through with each of the campuses is the visas that they're here on, and do their visas expire, or how long can they stay? And again, given some of the travel constraints, how do we help them find a safe and correct path forward?
We're talking with Robert Kramer, Vice President for Administration of the UW System. We're checking in to see how the UW is affected by the pandemic to date, what plans look like on the horizon. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Rana now, joining us from Cameron this morning. Hi, Rana.
Hi, good morning. Good morning to your guest. I'm just calling with support for the UW System. I am an alumni of the UW system, as well as my father, and we know that UW is doing everything that's possible to meet the needs of our students up there. My daughter's a junior at UW-Madison with a double major in computer engineering and aerospace engineering, and she landed a nice summer internship job with one of their at one of the science job fairs. We were fearful that it was going to be canceled, but because of UW's involvement in support of my student and the company that she's going to be working for, her internship is going to move forward. It's going to be an online internship, so it's going to be different. She's going to be working virtually. But we're just thankful that she's still able to have her internship. She's still able to move her career forward. And for that, we feel like the UW system has really gone above and beyond to help her out, because things could have just been dropped.
Rana, what a success story. Thank you for bringing that. Robert?
Well, I appreciate Rana's comments, and I wish her daughter success.
You've been talking about graduation recently, about celebrating some of the positives and realizing that this is a time of, you know, a rite of passage for those seniors. How should we be looking at graduations right now at the UW campuses?
Yeah, I think it is it's a celebration. The commencements will be different than they have been in the past. Each institution is trying to identify some different ways to celebrate with students, because this is an important milestone. But one of our early goals was to ensure that students could graduate and move forward with their plans. And I think that as we get to the end of April, early May, that's right upon us. The month of April has gone quickly, and I think it is a moment to pause and reflect and celebrate their successes. And again, thank the faculty and others who helped make it possible in this very trying environment.
Let's fit in another call now. Sonia in East Troy. Hi, Sonia.
Hi. I just have a quick question. My kids have gone to UW-Eau Claire, a great experience, wonderful campus. My daughter now is a junior. My son graduated in December. My question is grading. They've been given a lot of busy work, a lot of change in learning style, and she's struggling. So my question is, are they going to be going to pass-fail?
Robert, what about the grading system, pass-fail?
So each campus has been deciding what to do with respect to grading. I would encourage Sonia to have her daughter reach out to the faculty to identify what her options are. A number of the campuses have given students choices. A couple have gone to pass-fail, and several have decided to stay with the standard grade. So I would encourage her daughter to reach out to her professors, and I wish her success this year.
Well, Robert, thank you for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Kate, and thank you for all you're doing during these difficult times.
Robert Kramer is Vice President for Administration of the UW System. And for disclosure, Wisconsin Public Media employees are employees of the UW. Just ahead, we check in with the head of the Wisconsin Department of Veterans Affairs to see how veterans are getting by during the pandemic. And then we'll look at how the closing of meatpacking plants is affecting the country's food supply and how President Trump is responding. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.